Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. The trick to a war photographer's success is being at the right place at the right time. And of course, not getting wounded or captured or killed in the process. Jonathan Alperi believes the right place right now is Syria, and he's heading there next week for the second time since the rebellion began. Jonathan Alperi, our guest on Global Journalist today, has risked his life repeatedly to bring home photographs from nearly a dozen conflict zones, beginning with the South Caucasus as a freelancer in 2004. More recently, he documented the violence in Libya and Afghanistan. He's worked for Polaris Images and Getty for the past 4 years. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, and you're speaking to us from New York.
Yes, I am.
And you're getting ready to head back to Syria. Now, at least 16 journalists have been killed since November while covering Syria, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. That makes Syria the most dangerous place in the world for reporters and photographers. The assignment is particularly dodgy because the government of Bashar al-Assad has banned Western journalists and allows its soldiers to kill them. Jonathan, you snuck into Syria back in March on the one-year anniversary of the rebellion, and you barely escaped alive. Why are you going back next week?
Well, this time, instead of going through Turkey, I will most likely enter through Lebanon. And before going inside Syria, I was thinking of working in northern Lebanon, where now you have a lot of fighting against between pro and anti-Assad rebel groups. So I will probably most likely spend a couple of weeks, 2 weeks maybe, covering that and then going into homes to follow up on the story. Nobody's really talking about homes right now. The entire focus is on Aleppo and a little bit on Damascus. Not so much on Damascus because it's very difficult to get in there and get any footage out of it. And the homes would be a good side story that very few people are talking about, like in Lebanon.
And the how do you make these contacts to be able to get inside a country where foreign journalists aren't allowed?
Well, there's lots of ways to do it. I mean, you know, either Turkey or Lebanon, probably some journalists tried through Iraq, but there's fighting there too, and Jordan as well. There's lots of ways because there's a lot of people that I know personally who are willing to help me because we're friends.
Right.
And they smuggle you inside the country, but it's also become a business, like it was in Libya. So you pay people sometimes a crazy amount of money. I've never done that, obviously, because I know the right people on the ground. But for someone who's not as well connected, can pay up to like $2,000 or $3,000 a head to get smuggled inside the country to join the rebels or whatever you want to do as a journalist.
What's happening in Homs right now?
It's not clear who controls what. I mean, the stream of information is so sporadic, and you get a lot of information from local guys, and it's hard to verify whether or not. There seems to be still a lot of shelling. I'm sure there's plenty of military tactical operations on the rebel side and the government side. So there's a lot that we don't know that's going on. So yeah. I kind of have to go there and find out.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure we'd all like to know what's going on. And it's difficult because journalists are banned to get good information out of there. Now, overall, the conflict in Syria seemed to intensify this week. Both President Barack Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron warned Assad that using or even threatening to use chemical weapons could trigger a military intervention. If you were to place a bet, is there a better than even chance that Western troops will join the fight?
Well, I mean, I have various sources, and I think it's pretty safe to say now that there are on standby numerous commando units, like special forces from France, England, Jordan, maybe even Turkey and the United States, or on standby to go inside the country to make sure these chemical weapons don't fall into the wrong hands. So I'm sure there's already a lot of things happening that we don't know. Very small commando type units are active now, making sure where all these chemical weapons are, so when the time comes, they're going to take control of them.
Right. And some journalists who have recently returned from Syria, John Lee Anderson of the New Yorker magazine, for example, say the country is past the point of no return, and they foresee an extremely violent civil war. I wanted to have you share with our listeners and viewers how you keep up with what's happening in Syria. You don't just go on assignment and shoot photographs. You have to really know what's happening, at least as much as you can.
Yeah, I'm European in background, so I follow a lot of the European press, especially the French press, and so I keep informed like that. But I also have people that I'm very well connected with, either in Turkey or Lebanon, who keep me informed as well. And but I agree with the journalist that you mentioned before. It's been a point of no return for many months. It's not just now. I mean, I think
right.
since Holmes started the war started there in last February. I think there's too much bad blood. There's too much massacres on both sides, most likely. Now it's too late, and they will. That's why Assad has his back to the wall, and he's got nothing to lose now. Now, will he use chemical weapons? I think it's unlikely, but the consequences will be very grave. You can imagine a scenario where the Turkish army would invade. The Jordanian army would invade, so you have like a true regional conflict that could spiral out of control, and nobody really wants that, especially the Russians.
Right. I think getting the information, letting people know exactly what's going on, is so critical. But you mentioned your background. You were born in Paris 33 years ago. You moved with your family to New York City as a teenager, and then went to the University of Chicago to study medieval history. When did you decide to be a professional photographer?
I picked up, when I was about 16, 17, I went to the French high school in New York City, in Manhattan, and I used to travel already, and I would take pictures of, with a very cheap camera, and I would take pictures of ancient Roman sites throughout Europe and the Middle East. So that's how I started taking pictures. And in college, I got my first job working for local newspapers, and I got very bored of that very quickly. So I took a year off when I was 22, and in 2001, and I went to the South Caucasus. I went to Armenia and Georgia, and I started working as a photographer. And I got my first big contract with Getty Images in 2004, and then my career just went up quickly after that.
Do you remember your first camera?
I don't actually, and I remember what it looks like, but no, I don't remember.
But you've always been, I guess with your international background, you've always been interested in international events. And the what was the job you had in Chicago?
In terms of, I worked for local newspapers, so I was shooting, like local news in Chicago. That's pretty much how I started.
Okay, let's fast forward to your decision to come into Syria in March. Can you kind of describe your reasoning for going then, and just tell us what happened?
Well, I mean, there's a very practical reason and a less practical one. The practical reason is, I'm not sure all the viewers who intend to be photojournalists or are starting now, it's very hard to make money. There are not that many of us who can make a living out of it. So the one-year anniversary made sense, like it had to be at that time. In order to generate some sort of interest for clients from Polaris Images to buy the photos and my own clients.
Right.
So that's the practical side of it. Now the other thing is I was in Greece covering the crisis, which I did three times in the past 15 months, and I was based in Athens for a little bit, and I have very good colleagues there, and we decided to just go. It's right there. We can go through Turkey. We have a good contact who's going to get us in, and he did, and it worked out. I mean, we have very good stories.
Now you went in, and where did you go?
Well, first, what we did is that we flew from Athens to Istanbul, and then we took another flight, and we went to Gaziantep, which is on the Syrian border, and then we went to Antakya by car because the airport was flooded, so we had to drive. And then we waited at our hotel for a couple of days for things to get organized, and they smuggled us through the Turkish lines and then into Syrian territory to join the Free Syrian Army.
And what's describe what's who these rebels are and what kind of skirmishes you saw or what kind of operations you saw there. But I'm kind of interested in letting people know from what your experience was who these rebels are. Your photographs are very beautiful portraits and sometimes intense. So can you just kind of describe a bit about them?
Well, when we arrived and we linked up with the guys, there was an enclave, which was pretty much in pretty small mountains with a few villages that were still controlled by a handful of rebels. And when we arrived, it was very dangerous because the rebels were losing. They just lost Idlib, and they were just in full retreat. They had taken many casualties. And when we arrived, all these guys were retreating back to the Turkish border, which is a safe haven. And but so obviously, we followed them for a bit, and we went back to where the fighting was. And a lot of these people are, and you have a lot of army deserters. So they're the best trained, best equipped, and often the leaders will come out of that. But you also have, local guys from local villages who want to defend their hometown, And since everybody has weapons, they'll fight. You also have people who seek revenge. They lost a brother or a friend or a family member, and they want to get back to the government. And you also have pretty hardcore Islamists that we met that were there and were very pro bin Laden. And they actually asked us what we felt about that. So we're just like, we're not here for political reasons, so we try to evade the question. But you have some pretty hardcore Islamists who are fighting this war.
How many, from what you're gathered personally, and from what you know from other people who have been there and witnessed what's going on, how big of a contingency of these Islamist extremists with links to Al Qaeda are there? Is it like 5%, 20%? What would your guess be?
It's impossible to know the number, but I would say it's no more than 5. But it's probably a very small amount of number. Like every extremist group, so it's a small band of guys. But it's enough to create havoc, especially when you have chemical weapons throughout the country. And these guys would love to get their hands on it.
Right. And the I understand things got a bit dangerous for you there, and you decided to leave. Can you tell us kind of what happened toward the end of your stay there and why you decided to get out?
Well, we after spending over a week and a half in that combat zone, we ended up spending 2 days in the actual the worst area of that enclave, where there was about a dozen or so rebels who were held up and trying to contain whatever government troops there were. The fighting got really intense. There's a lot of it was getting closer and closer, and I didn't feel comfortable anymore because I did not trust their tactical sense anymore.
Right.
And they kept saying how everything is okay, and I didn't believe it. My colleague and I were talking, and because at one point we were attacked by a raid of government troops, so all the rebels rushed out of that house where we were and just left us alone.
Wow.
Without knowing. So we had to make a decision quickly, since very few people speak English, so it was hard to understand what was going on. And when they came back, there's all this fighting going on. Like, we pushed them back, but now there's 12 tanks half a click away, and we don't know what they're going to do. So we decided to pull out, and we did. And I think then 12 hours later, the entire position was destroyed. And I had just this feeling that it was time for us to go.
So you got out just in time.
Oh, yeah.
You traveled with the refugees across the border as well. Tell us about what that scene was like, being with the refugees and how the civilians relate to the rebels.
Most of the civilians are, support in some degree or another the rebellion. They don't like Bashar Assad, but they're still pretty wary about these armed groups. For us, the big scoop wasn't so much the fighting. It was being with the refugees, because at the time, there was no one has ever really taken pictures of actual refugees fleeing from inside Syria into Turkey. Most of the work was done in the refugee camps. So we got very lucky because our guy was like, listen, you're going to join about 150 family members, and you are going to flee with them back into Turkey. And that's what happened. Everybody was, you know, carrying whatever they could carry. Many, many children. At one point, I had to carry, you know, children as well because we were being slowed down. Then they put us on the truck to speed up, and then we had to walk through the mountains for quite a while into the Turkish border, and then we're split up. Because once they get to the border, they just go to the Turkish army and they get channeled into Turkey. For us, we had to be smuggled back into Turkey legally in order to evade, in order not to be deported.
Now, so did you, these refugees now, it's becoming a pretty critical situation. Now I think Turkey's putting limits on how many people can go there. So it seems like a lot of these refugees are kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. If they can't get into Turkey, they're surrounded by Syrian troops. And what was the mood among these refugees? And tell us what you think about the overall problem with refugees.
I mean, obviously the numbers are going to increase. Turkey can, I don't know how many they have now, maybe 200,000.
Right.
I'm not sure.
That's the number I've heard, yeah.
I mean, they could take more if they wanted to, but the question is, do they want to? Probably not. No, Jordan has less resources. I think they have tons of refugees as well. The people that we met, they were just, you know, very happy to leave, you know, and they want to come back after the war was over, which is far from over now. So they're most likely still in these camps now.
Right. Now, before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You could also follow us on Twitter at @gjournalist. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about your photographs. I noticed that you do a lot of intimate portraits of soldiers. One that struck me in particular was the soldier on horseback with looked like an AK-47, and he was riding without a saddle. Looks like he was a pretty good rider. I wanted to find out. You have some military veterans in your family background, right? Does that play a role in your interest in soldiers?
Yeah, I mean, when somebody asks me why I do what I do for a living, the main reason is my family's background. It's true. I have a lot of family members who fought in World War I, World War II, the French Indochina War, Algeria, or the War of Independence in Spain. So I was kind of brought up in it. Like, you know, I would read the stories. I would, you know, meet these family members, and they would talk to me about it. So it was kind of in my blood to begin with. So that's how the interest developed into what I'm doing now today.
And you also tell us about some of your work outside of being a war photographer. You shoot to make ends meet and pay your mortgage in New York City. You do some fashion photography, and we also have a real interesting project on World War II veterans. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I when I was living in Southern California, I was looking for a project, and I've always been truly interested by World War II for all kinds of reasons, and partially because World War II created who we are today in many ways. And so I'd start shooting American World War II vets, but after a while, so that was boring. It needed to be more. So what I did is 5 years, I went around, plus the work that I do usually, and I photographed 62 different.
Mm-hmm. I think we lost our connection. Let's see if we can get it back, and we'll take a break. Are you back, Jonathan?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Okay. We had just had a bit of a break there. Sorry.
No problem.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I was saying, I photographed over 200 guys from both sides, and it took me about 5 years. And that was a big exhibition in Soho in this spring, and there's hopefully a book coming out sometime next year.
Oh, that's interesting. How can people can they see any of the work in progress?
I mean, the work is finished. It's been finished for about 2 years. They can go on my website and see a selection.
What? Tell us your website.
It's jonathanalperi.net, and Alperi is A-L-P like Peter, E-Y-R-I-E.net, so jonathanalperi.net.
Now, I noticed there's some similarities with these soldiers. You have photographs of fighters in East Africa, Afghanistan, Libya, and the Caucasus. Do you see commonalities to these people who are involved in the conflicts?
I mean, a soldier, I guess, is a soldier anywhere in the world. So in that sense, yes. And as a photojournalist, to take true combat photos is nice. No, that's okay. But the real good work and the photos that hopefully can be remembered or can, win a prize, for example, or have meanings or pictures are, like you said, more personal things that are a little bit more off the beaten path, not necessarily a guy just shooting his machine gun on a wall, doing something crazy. So sort of to look into something deeper and something more consistent like that.
They tend to smoke a lot, it seems.
What's that?
They tend to smoke a lot, it seems.
Oh yeah. I've never picked that up. They all do, that's for sure. Especially in Syria, it's crazy. They smoke like I've never met anybody smoke.
Is it partly just because of the nerves relaxing them a bit?
Even for me, like when I'm out there and I'm stressed out, like a cigarette does help, that's for sure. But the Syrians love their cigarettes like the Turks. It's crazy.
Yeah. How do they pick their leaders? How does it seem like they pick their leaders? They seem like such a diverse group. I know, and then some of the members are defectors from Assad's military, but some of those are conscripts, right? Like, don't they have a compulsory military in Syria?
Is it a professional army? I don't know. The problem that the Syrian army has is, like you said, there's different kinds of groups of people. You have the Kurds in the north, Shiites and the Sunnis. That explains why you have a lot of desertions. But the Syrian army is having major problems with its infantry, because I think a lot of their guys don't want to be going out there and killing their own people. So it's a difficult situation for them.
Tell us who sticks in your mind. What's people you shot photographs of, and tell us a little bit more about them and why you decided to focus your lens on them.
I covered a couple of conflicts in Somalia and Ethiopia, and I spent quite some time with different rebel groups fighting the Ethiopian government there. And they often use a lot of women in their fighting units, and I was always very impressed by that because their treatment of women was equal as how a male soldier would be seen and used in combat. And that's why I have these medium format series, which some of them made shows in New York City, and of women just, being like men and fighting like men.
Now, you're going to be joining them again soon. How are you physically and mentally preparing for this trip?
Physically, I've been an athlete all my life, so I still am. I can walk. I can go through physical pain. That's fine. But mentally, you're always a little nervous, which is good. It keeps you on your toes, and it reminds you that you need to be careful. Syria is such a you never know how things are going to happen. So yeah, you do worry about it. But once you're on the plane and you go, you're good to go.
How long do you plan on staying? If it gets really bad, will you stay longer, or what are your plans?
I'm planning. I'm gone for a month, but I have to be in Europe for about a week. So I'll be out there in Lebanon and Syria for 3 weeks.
Since you are a freelancer and you have to go where you think the story is, where else are you looking, and what other places in the world should we be concerned about as far as escalating violence?
Mexico.
Yeah, notice you did some shots in Mexico. Yeah, there is some serious fighting there. That's dangerous as well, right?
Yeah, Mexico, it's a different kind of danger, but Mexico is bad, and it's not covered as much as it should. But in terms of other places, I mean, the Middle East, obviously. Is, I mean, Iran. Iran is the real prize for the West. I think Syria is just a sideshow. The real problem is Iran.
Do you think that? I mean, why you know, if you compare this with Libya, and why do you think that the Western nations are so reticent to get more involved in Syria?
Well, I mean, the main problem they have is Russia. Obviously, Russia is drawing a line in terms of what the alliances are. I mean, that Syria has been an ally to Russia for 40 years. So if we start messing with Syria and Iran, then we're dealing with the Russians. And the Russians have very good cards up their sleeves, like natural gas, which supplies a lot of Europe, especially Germany. So it's trickier. And they're part of the UN Security Council, permanent, with China. So we have to deal with them. And Libya was a much easier conflict. It ended pretty quickly. Casualty rates were much lower, so it was easier for France and England to intervene militarily. Syria would be much more difficult. I don't think they have the stomach for it either.
Right. And you mentioned, I've seen on your website, you've said that Syria is the most dangerous and unpredictable place you've been. Is that because of the government's position on Western journalists?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they've captured and killed a bunch of Western journalists purposely or not purposely, but... Yeah, Syria is probably now one of the most difficult things to do, and also, you know, not that many journalists have done it. Also, it's more now, obviously, opening up a little bit. But I would say Syria is definitely by far right now the most dangerous thing it can do.
And I imagine that you have family in New York City.
I do. My father lives here, and my sister lives in Boston.
Do they think you're crazy?
No, I mean, everybody's, you know, respects what I do. I mean, they all worry, of course, but my girlfriend is not enjoying this whatsoever. But, you know, it's my life. So.
Right. And what does he do there in New York?
My dad is a businessman, and he's a headhunter, and he's been working for a firm here forever.
Right. And your wife, I mean, your girlfriend?
My girlfriend is from Brazil, and she lives here, and she's been living in the U.S. for about 8 years now, and now she's in New York City. She's a general manager for a French restaurant.
Yeah, and how long do you think you'll be doing this this type of work? Do you see this as a lifelong occupation?
No, I don't. I'm not one of these guys who want to keep doing that until I'm 60. I mean, you know, there's only so many chances you get. But to survive these trips, right. I don't know. I feel my 30s for sure. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Jonathan, we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Our guest today was Jonathan Alperi, a photojournalist preparing for another perilous trip to a war zone. I'm sure everyone listening shares my hope that you return safely. And thank you so much for telling us your story today and documenting what is happening in Syria.
No, thank you for having me.
All right. Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our director is Travis McMillan. Audio is engineered by Pat Akers, and Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer and the producer of today's program. Join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.